This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with rifle legend Lonis Wigger, a two-time Olympic gold medalist. He lives in Colorado Springs now, where he volunteers at the U.S. Olympic Training Center. There's a great tour you can take there, by the way, if you ever find yourself in that neck of the woods. Mr. Wigger is originally from the tiny town of Carter, Montana, and it was one of his grade school classmates, Barbara Troisi, who introduced us. Thanks, Barbara. You'll find a photo of those two on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. In between his Olympic appearances, Lonis had two tours of duty in Vietnam. And you've shared what some of those assignments were. I guess I have to ask you the obvious question. Did you ever have moments there where you felt that your life was really in danger, that you might not make it home to see your wife and kids again or ever compete in another Olympics?
Yeah, a couple of times. I wasn't in the field a lot, but I was in the field quite a bit the first tour and got shot at. And in our compound, they would shoot recoilless rifles at us, which were used kind of like mortars. They'd set up in a tree line. They'd lob three or four in. A lot of times they'd land in the compound. The night before I left the Delta, we were right in the middle of Tet, and we got a shelling from recoilless rifles. My roommate was a bird dog pilot. He flew as a spotter pilot, and the airfield was about 5 miles out. And he was getting ready to go out and fly the plane that night. He'd sent the crew chief around the back to get the Jeep parked in front of our hooch. And we had a little revetment wall about 3 feet high right across in front of us. That Jeep was sitting there. He went inside and was running. And about that time, I was standing in my room in my underwear. This first round hit in the compound, and I zipped out the door. And normally we went to the corners where we had bunkers. That's where you went to. You know, of course, we had a big fence around us and so on. That's where we went to right away if we had an attack. Well, the sergeant major lived in the hooch next to me, and he and I were getting pretty short. So we built a little short-timer bunker kind of in between our two hooches, which is only about 3 or 4 feet high and just room for a couple of people. Well, that first round hit, and I was in the short-timer bunker, and I'm laying there, and I hear this round come in, hit the Jeep. The Jeep wasn't more than 20 yards from me, and had that revetment wall, and hit that Jeep, blew up and was burning. And I'm laying here in this short-timer bunker, and all of a sudden, here come people into the bunker. We must have got five of them in there, and they're all laying on top of me. It didn't bother me a bit. So as soon as the shelling stopped, when we jumped up and ran in and got my rifle and went to the command bunker. So the doc came in, and he said, so-and-so is down back in the bunker. He says, he's been wounded, and he's only been there about a week. He says, I'll go back and get him. So they went and got him, several, and brought him into the command bunker, and they had him in there, and they couldn't do anything for him. He died shortly. In the meantime, they'd call for a medevac chopper to come in and pick him up. Well, he died, and so the commander there says, Wigger, he says, get a Jeep. I want you to take the body out to the airfield and put it on that helicopter coming in. And I thought to myself, he's dead. He doesn't need to go out till tomorrow. We don't know what's coming. They're ground attacking all over the country at bases. And we were expecting to get a ground attack. So two other guys volunteered to go with me. So we got a Jeep, we loaded the body in and zipped out to the airfield. And I expected to get ambushed on the way. And we got out there, and the helicopter just got in and landed. So we got up, drove up to it, and we got the body loaded. And there were local Vietnamese that were trying to get on the helicopter. They didn't know where it was going. They just wanted to get away, you know, and they're trying to get off, and they kept kicking them off and pushing them off and everything until they could get off the ground. I remember when they took off, they still had a couple of them hanging on to the skids. One of them went up about 20 feet before it finally dropped off. It went on, and so we jumped back in the Jeep and zipped back to the compound, still expecting to get an ambush. We didn't. We got back, and so that was a pretty scary last night for me. Getting shot at down there, it makes you think a little. A
couple broad questions I want to ask you, just because I think it's important to get perspective for someone who lived during this time and did what you did. I'm guessing that you've been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., and seen those 58,000-plus names. What does that mean to you? And when you think back on that time and what you did and what all those names on that wall did, how do you think they should be remembered? What's the significance of that today?
I have seen the memorial, and it's really something to see. I've looked at it quite a bit and found names of people that I knew, some friends and so on. So it really does make you wonder. But I guess what really upsets me about the whole thing is we had that war won, and we blew it. The media blew it. After the Tet Offensive, they were in bad shape. We had them. But the media here said we lost the Tet Offensive. We didn't lose the Tet Offensive. We had them exactly at that point where we wanted them. And the fact that we go into wars and we don't try to win anymore, And you could see the same thing in Afghanistan and Iraq. We go in and people get killed and we pull out and we haven't done anything. We haven't accomplished anything because we don't go to win. If you're not going to go to win, you shouldn't go. That's the way I feel about it. There's no reason why we couldn't have won that war over there. We'd have went ahead and bombed Hanoi and bombed the supply route that they run down through. That's where they infiltrated. That's where they came down by the hundreds. But you couldn't go over there and do anything. It's so stupid. If you're going to fight a war, you fight to win. And I think most of the military people felt that way. But we weren't allowed to win. And it's even worse now. Engagement rules are just unbelievable. You get shot at in Afghanistan, he shoots at you out of a building, he drops his gun and walks out, you can't do anything. That's the engagement rule. Unless they shoot at you and you see him, you can't return the fire. That's crazy. I'm glad that I'm not over there involved in that anymore. People aren't going to like what I said, but that's the way it is. You know, I'm old enough, I can say what I want.
Well, and you come out of this situation, and I'm sure both times you got home from Vietnam to see your wife and kids again had to be special. And then as you go back to a third Olympic Games in Munich in 72, I imagine you had a perspective that not many of those Olympians had, having been a sniper instructor, having been in combat, having seen that Jeep blow up not far from you and knowing how close you came. Here you are in Munich when the infamous hostage situation arises. And you saw that firsthand? You saw what happened there?
Pretty much. First of all, I got back in December of 71. Well, the two best small bore shooters in the world were at the marksmanship unit at that time, Jack Ryder and Lanny Basham. And they'd been there training. And you only take two small bore. So my chances of making the team small bore were pretty slim. And I knew one of us wasn't going to make the team. It'd probably be me. But they had two more slots for 300 meters. Centerfire rifle. So I started training 300 meter. I figured that was my best shot at making the team. So I trained and I made the team and then trained all summer. And when I went to Munich, that's what I shot was the 300 meter centerfire rifle. So they won the gold and silver in small bore and I won the gold in 300 meter. Primarily because I changed my attitude a little bit and decided that I'm going to go for the one that I think I can make the team. But yes, going back to the what happened in Munich, fortunately the shooting events were over at the time because they would have canceled the shooting just because it was guns, you know, that's what would happen. But we were finished. I think we were finished like 1 or 2 days. I had been to a party at one of the shooters' houses that evening and came back. The guy dropped me off at the village, and I didn't want to walk all the way around and come in the gate, so I just climbed the fence. It was pretty close to where I lived. I just climbed the fence and went in and went to bed. Well, that same night is when the Palestinians climbed the fence just about the same place I did. They had athlete sweats on. They climbed the fence and come in. They went in the building where the Israelis were, up on the third or fourth floor. And that's when they got them all together, herded them together, and killed one or two of them. And then the next morning, they were able to get a vehicle, and they brought them down. And, of course, by that time, the next morning, word was all around. We were all standing outside watching it, and they were within 100 yards of me. And I saw them bring them out and put them on a bus, and there were like four of them that had masks on, who knew who they were. And here I am sitting there, being a former sniper and instructor and a target shooter and knowing what it would take. Of course, nothing was being done, and they wouldn't, of course, do anything in the village anyway, but they took them on the bus and took them to the airfield. So that's when it happened. So, yeah, I was pretty close to the first hand. Yeah, it is something. It's unbelievable, quite frankly. In those days, we just didn't have the security that we needed. We never needed it, really, before that. And, you know, like a couple of days before that, third or fourth cousin of mine from North Dakota who was in the military, was stationed in Germany. He found out I was in the village. He'd come in, climbed the fence, and come in to see me a couple of days before that. And, you know, you just didn't think about it, that happening. Of course, that changed things from that point on now that you have maximum security everywhere. And I think they canceled the games the next day for a day, and they had a big memorial in the stadium, and then they went ahead and finished the games.
I know we're getting short on time here, and there's a lot of your career that we haven't touched on. I want to hit the high points with you, but I guess one thing real quick that we should touch on is you were going to be going to the Olympics in 1980. They were supposed to be in Moscow in Russia, and here we are in 2014, and we have the Winter Olympics in Russia, in Sochi. Does that bring back any of those feelings that you remember from 1980?
Of course, I've been there and had my opportunities, but there's a lot of people in that 80 team that never got to go to Olympics. And they didn't get to go. And it was so stupid. What President Carter tried to do was just unconscionable, quite frankly. And there was no reason. They weren't going to approve anything by a boycotting, but they did. And they were talking about boycotting this year, too, and some people wanted them to. But I don't think you can boycott. I don't think you can give in to those kind of people. I think you've got to face it, do what you need to do, to prevent it and go. Otherwise, you're going to live in your home behind your fence, scared all your life. You can't do anything. So, no, if I was on this Olympic team, I'd go. Now, I might not let my family go to live out somewhere, but if I was going in the village and to the venues and participating, no question I'd go.
And I know it's—I don't want to insult the rest of your career by glossing over it here, but you stayed in the Army for 26 years, and you continued to teach marksmanship. I'm curious, in all that time at Fort Benning, did you ever sneak your way onto one of those famous jump towers they have there and try to parachute down from 200 feet up?
No, I was smarter than that. But I formed the junior rifle program at Fort Benning in the mid-70s, and I ran that until I left. And we had a very, very successful program, and we had the best team in the country, junior team in the country at the time. We won everything. A lot of the kids that I trained, maybe not necessarily I trained, but our group trained, went on to military academies, went on and made international teams and won medals. At one time, I think there were counted up something like 30 kids that had gone on and got college degrees and shot in the universities and in the military academies. I felt like, you know, I had accomplished something there with that, and we had an excellent program.
You've been here in Colorado Springs for more than a quarter century now, continuing here at the Olympic Training Center. Give us a quick nutshell sketch of what you do here and why you do it.
Well, I left the Army in 87, and they offered me the job. They had built this facility, I think, in 85, and they offered me the job to run the program here. I'm a full-time volunteer now, and I do whatever I can do to help and promote. I'm also the president of the Alumni Association. So if I can get myself in case where they have to have me, say they won't kick me out, so I'll have a place to go every day.
I know when you've got Olympic gold medals, maybe you're not waiting for a crystal trophy somewhere, but a few years ago they decided to make you another trailblazer again. No shooter had ever been inducted in the Olympic Hall of Fame, the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame, and they decided to put you in that class, in that category, the greatest Olympians ever. What did that mean to you? What was that experience like?
Well, I don't know how you would explain it. I mean, it's just something that doesn't happen to shooters. I mean, you know, most people in this country don't even know shooting is an Olympic sport. And the media, of course, never covers shooting sports because it's guns. So you don't receive much media attention. Email was what helped me get elected. I was nominated. People have been trying to get me nominated for quite a while. My son, one of them, every time he came out here, he was over USOC talking to the lady, to the point where when she seen coming, I think she locked the door. But, you know, wanting something to be done. Somehow or other, in 2008, I was placed on the list. I think it was like 18 on the list. They were going to pick 8, I think, something along that line. I had a gal working here, and she sent an email out to everybody who belonged to USA Shooting to go online and vote for me. She said that I'd been selected. I thought she'd pull my leg. I didn't think it was any way. It turned out that I got the second most votes to be inducted. Probably the epitome, climax of my career.
Well, I can see the emotion in your eyes as you talk about that. And as we bring this to a close, first of all, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for representing our country. You've done that about as much as anybody possibly could. So I guess the last question I have for you is, what are you most proud of, and what do you hope that your legacy is? Because so many people, especially in the shooting world, look up to you. And your kids have caught the shooting bug and are passing that on to other generations. What are you most proud of, and what do you hope people remember your name for?
Well, that's a pretty tough question. I've never even thought about a legacy. All I think about is what I have to do tomorrow. And I still am active in shooting, not at that level anymore, but I do shoot the NRA Nationals at Camp Perry every summer. And in fact, this summer, my three kids... My daughter was on the 88 Olympic team. My three kids have shot, and the other two went to Eastern Kentucky on a shooting scholarship. We were able to get them all together at Camp Perry this year, and we shot as a four-man team, only the second time we ever did that. We ended up coming in second place in the open category, so I was pretty proud of that. It made the whole summer worthwhile, so pretty proud of that happening. And as far as trying to name something that stands out, that's pretty tough. I've had a lot of ups. I forget the downs. A lot of good things happened. I got to see a lot of the world. My wife was able to travel with me quite a bit. She says, yeah, I've been everywhere, but the only thing I've ever seen is all the best shooting ranges in the world. So, you know, we've been fortunate. We've been lucky to travel the world, see everything. I haven't found anywhere in the world I'd rather be than here, and I'm glad to be here. I don't really care to travel over there anymore. I'd like to be able to come in here every day and help out wherever I can, and I don't coach anymore. I tried that for a while, but there wasn't enough people that had money enough to make it worthwhile, so I tried it for a while and didn't work. But I don't get involved in the coaching of the kids here. If one of them comes to me and talks to me and asks me, I'll help them. I'll tell them what I think. I know what it takes to win. I think I can teach that to them. You got to be a winner first to learn how to win. You know, you have to know that. And I can still teach that. But like I say, I don't push myself on anybody. If they want to come to me, I'll help them all I can. But I think probably if I had to name one, making the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame is probably the epitome of it all.
That is Lonis Wigger, two-time Olympic gold medalist and 26 years in the U.S. Army, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. If you'd like to see his gold medals as they're displayed at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Back to the World War II generation next time when we remind you again that freedom is not free.